mainland. This fellow will serve me as a pilot, and will tell me what to do, and whither to go for provisions, and whither not to go for fear of being devoured. I waked with this thought, and was under such inexpressible impressions of joy at the prospect of my escape in my dream, that the disappointments which I felt upon coming to myself and finding it was no more than a dream were equally extravagant the other way, and threw me into a very great dejection of spirits. Upon this, however, I made this conclusion. My only way to go about an escape was to get a savage into my possession. If possible, it should be one of their prisoners whom they had condemned to be eaten, and should bring hither to kill. But these thoughts still were attended with this difficulty. It was impossible to effect this without attacking a whole caravan of them and killing them all. This was not only a very desperate attempt, and might miscarry, but I had scrupled the lawfulness of it to myself. My heart trembled at the thoughts of shedding so much blood, though it was for my deliverance from this island. I need not repeat the arguments which occurred to me against this, they being the same mentioned before. I had other reasons to offer now, viz., that those men were enemies to my life, and would devour me if they could. It was self-preservation in the highest degree to deliver myself from this death of a life, and I was acting in my own defense as much as if they were assaulting me. These things argued for it, yet the thoughts of shedding human blood for my deliverance were very terrible to me, and such as I could by no means reconcile myself to for a great while. However, at last, after many secret disputes with myself, and after great perplexities about it, for all these arguments, one way and another, struggled in my head a long time, the eager, prevailing desire of escape at length mastered all the rest. I resolved, if possible, to get one of those savages into my hands, cost what it would. My next thing was to contrive how to do it, and this indeed was very difficult to resolve on. As I could pitch upon no probable means for it, so I resolved to put myself upon the watch, to see them when they came on shore, and leave the rest to the event, taking such measures as the opportunity should present. With these resolutions in my thoughts, I set myself upon the scout as often as possible, and indeed so often I was heartily tired of it. It was above a year and a half I waited. For the great part of that time I went out to the West End, and to the awful church of the southwest corner of the island, almost every day to look for canoes, but none appeared. This was very discouraging, and began to trouble me much. Though I cannot say that it did in this case, as it had done some time before, wear off the edge of my desire to the thing. The longer it seemed to be delayed, the more eager I was for it. In a word, I was not at first so careful to shun the sight of these savages, and avoid being seen by them, as I was now eager to be upon them. About a year and a half after I entertained these notions, as I have said, I was surprised one morning with seeing no less than 5 canoes, all on shore together, on my side of the island, and the people who belonged to them all landed and out of my sight. The number of them broke all my measures. Seeing so many, and knowing they always came 4 or 6, or sometimes more, in a boat, I could not tell what to think of it, or how to take my measures to attack 20 or 30 men, single-handed. However, I put myself into all the same postures for an attack that I had formerly provided, and was just ready for action if anything had presented. Having waited a good while, listening to hear if they made any noise, at length, being very impatient, I set my guns at the foot of my ladder and clambered up to the top of the hill. Here, I observed, by the help of my perspective glass, which was this time by selection the better of the 2 I had, they were no less than 30 in number. They had a fire kindled, and they had meat dressed. How they had cooked it I knew not, or what it was. They were all dancing and writhing in their own way, round the fire, bellowing and braying words that were but sounds to distant me, but awful nonetheless for it. Their naked skin, I could see, was slick and grey, like that of an eel, and with their hunched backs and wide eyes, they made for a most monstrous crowd of figures. Also I observed, as their hands would be thrown up, that each man and woman among them had very long fingers, enough so that it could be observed through the glass. In a like manner were their feet long and broad, as each would kick up their legs in the wild dancing. I bethought myself that there was little doubt such a foot had left the long-ago print which had shaped my life on the island since and up till this moment. It did also occur to me that the full moon had been only one night earlier, and had the savages arrived the day before, a most unpleasant surprise would have met them upon the shore. Even now I could sense the beast's great dislike of these beings, and had little doubt it would have hunted many of them for the mere pleasure of the kill. While I was thus looking on them, I perceived, by my perspective, two miserable wretches dragged from the boats, where, it seemed, they were laid by, and were now brought out for the slaughter. I observed one of them fall, being knocked down, I suppose, with a club or wooden sword, for that was their way, and two or three others were at work, cutting him open for their cookery, while the other victim was left standing by himself till they should be ready for him. In that very moment, this poor wretch, seeing himself at little liberty and unbound, started away from them and ran with incredible swiftness along the sands towards me, I mean, towards that part of the coast where my habitation was. I was frightened, I must acknowledge, when I perceived him run my way, and when, as I thought, I saw him pursued by the whole body. Now I expected that part of my dream was coming to pass, and that he would certainly take shelter in my grove, but I could not depend upon my dream for the rest of it, viz., that the other savages would not pursue him thither and find him there. However, I kept my station, and my spirits began to recover when I found there was not above three men that followed him. Still more, I was encouraged when I found he outstripped them in running, and gained ground of them. If he could but hold it for half an hour, I saw he would fairly get away from them all, for he ran true, and the three ran in a shambling manner. Not true running, but a manner of throwing one leg before the other, as a man who has not yet found his sea legs, as sailors call them, sometimes will walk on deck. There was between them and my castle the creek, which I mentioned often in the first part of my story, where I landed my cargoes out of the ship. This I saw the poor wretch must swim over, or he would be taken there. When the escaping savage came thither, he made nothing of it, though the tide was then up. Plunging in, he swam through in about 30 strokes, landed, and ran on with exceeding strength and swiftness. When the three persons came to the creek, I found two of them could swim, but the third would not. Standing on the other side, he looked at the others, but went no farther, and soon went back again, which, as it happened, was very well for him in the end. I observed the two who swam, though clumsy apace, were yet more than twice as fast swimming over the creek as the fellow was that fled from them. It came now upon my thoughts, and indeed irresistibly, that now was the time to get me a servant, and perhaps a companion or assistant, and I was called plainly by Providence to save this poor creature's life. I ran down the ladders with all possible expedition, fetched my two guns, and getting up again to the top of the hill, I crossed towards the sea. Having a very short cut, and all downhill, I placed myself in the way between the pursuers and the pursued, hallooing aloud to him that fled. Looking back, he was at first as much frightened at me as at them. I beckoned with my hand to him to come back. In the meantime, I advanced towards the two that followed. Rushing at once upon the foremost, I knocked him down with the stock of my piece. I was loath to fire because I would not have the rest here, though at that distance they would not have known what to make of it. Having knocked this fellow down, the other who pursued him stopped, as if he had been frightened, and I advanced a pace towards him. As I came nearer, I perceived he had a bow and arrow, and was fitting it to shoot at me. I was then necessitated to shoot at him first, which I did, and killed him at the first shot. The poor savage who fled, though he saw both his enemies fallen and killed, was so frightened with the fire and noise of my piece, he stood stock still, and neither came forward nor went backward. He rather seemed inclined still to fly. I hallooed him again, and made signs to come forward, which he understood, and came a little way. Then stopped again, and then a little farther, and stopped again. I could then perceive he stood trembling, as if he had been taken prisoner just to be killed, as his two enemies were. I beckoned him again to come to me, and gave him all the signs of encouragement I could think of. He came nearer and nearer, kneeling down every 10 or 12 steps in token of acknowledgement for saving his life. I smiled at him and looked pleasantly, and beckoned him to come still nearer. At length he came close to me. He kneeled down again, kissed the ground, and laid his head upon the ground, and taking me by the foot, set my foot upon his head. This, it seems, was in token of swearing to be my slave for ever. I took him up and made much of him, and encouraged him all I could. But there was more work to do yet. I perceived the savage whom I knocked down was not killed, but stunned with the blow, and began to come to himself. I pointed to him, and showed my savage he was not dead. Upon this he spoke some words to me, and though I could not understand them, I thought they were pleasant to hear, for they were the first sound of a man's voice I had heard for above 25 years. But there was no time for such reflections now. The savage who was knocked down recovered himself so far as to sit up upon the ground, and I perceived my savage, for so I call him now, began to be afraid. When I saw that, I presented my other piece at the other man, as if I would shoot him. Upon this, my savage made a motion to me, and took up the other savage's great wooden sword, which had fallen when I struck him. My savage no sooner had it, but he ran to his enemy, and, at one blow, cut off his head so cleverly, no executioner in Germany could have done it sooner or better. When he had done this, he came laughing to me in triumph, and brought me the sword again, and, with abundance of gestures which I did not understand, laid it down just before me with the head of the savage he had killed. I turned to go away, and beckoned him to follow me, making signs to him more might come after them. Upon this, he made signs to me he should bury the bodies with sand, that they might not be seen by the rest if they followed. I made signs to him again to do so. He fell to work, and in an instant he had scraped a hole in the sand with his broad hands big enough to bury the first in, then dragged him into it and covered him, and did so by the other also. I believe he had buried them both in a quarter of an hour. Then calling him away, I carried him not to my castle, but quite away to my cave on the farther part of the island. So I did not let my dream come to pass in that part, viz., that he came into my grove for shelter. Here I gave him bread and a bunch of raisins to eat, and a draught of water, which I found he was indeed in great distress for, by his running. Having refreshed him, I made signs for him to go and lie down to sleep, showing him a place where I had laid some rice straw and a blanket upon it, which I used to sleep upon myself sometimes. The poor creature lay down and went to sleep. He was a comely fellow, oddly made, with long straight limbs, not too large or tall, well-shaped despite the hunch to his back, and, as I reckon, about 26 years of age. The smell of fish did hang about him like a cloud, as if it were his only sustenance. His hands were long and flat, with fingers as long again, and I bethought myself that he could wrap his whole head within them. Likewise, were his feet and toes long and broad, with a tiny claw on each rather than a toenail. Yet, as I examined them more, I was amazed to see a thin web of skin twixt each splayed toe, as one would see on the feet of a duck. He had a very good countenance, not a fierce and surly aspect, but seemed to have something very manly in his face. Yet he had all the sweetness and softness of a European in his countenance, too, especially when he smiled. His hair was long and black, not curled like wool. His forehead very high and large, a great vivacity and sparkling sharpness in his large, dark eyes, though not as wide apart as those of the other savages. The colour of his skin was, again, not quite the slick grey of the other savages, but very dusky, and yet not an ugly, mottled, nauseous dusky, but of a bright kind of a polished slate colour that had in it something very agreeable, though not very easy to describe. His face was round and plump, his nose small and thin, not flat like the negroes, yet with long slit. A very good mouth, thin lips, and his long thin teeth well set, and as white as ivory. I left him sleeping, and went to tend my businesses. My new servant, many lessons, two monsters. After the savage had slumbered about half an hour, he awoke and came out of the cave to me, for I had been milking my goats, which I had in the enclosure just by. When he espied me, he came running to me, laying himself down again upon the ground with all the possible signs of an humble, thankful disposition. At last he laid his head flat upon the ground very close to my foot, and set my other foot upon his head, as he had done before. After this, he made all the signs to me of subjection, servitude, and submission imaginable. I understood him in many things, and let him know I was very well pleased with him. In a little time I began to speak to him, and teach him to speak to me. First, I let him know his name should be Friday, which was the day I saved his life. I likewise taught him to say Master, and then let him know that was to be my name. I likewise taught him to say yes and no, and to know the meaning of them. I gave him some milk in an earthen pot, and let him see me drink it before him, and sop my bread in it. I gave him a cake of bread to do the like, which he complied with, and made signs it was very good for him. I kept there with him all night. As soon as it was day, I beckoned to him to come with me, and let him know I would give him some clothes, at which he seemed very glad, for he was stark naked. As we went by the place where he had buried the two men, he showed me the marks he had made to find them again, making signs to me we should dig them up and eat them. At this I appeared very angry, expressed my abhorrence of it, made as if I would vomit at the thoughts of it, and beckoned with my hands to him to come away. He did, with great submission. I then led him up to the top of the hill, to see if his enemies were gone. Pulling out my perspective glass, I looked and saw plainly the place where they had been, but no appearance of them or their canoes. It was plain they were gone, and had left their two comrades behind without any search after them. But I was not content with this discovery. Having now more courage, and consequently more curiosity, I took my man Friday with me. Away we marched to the place where these creatures had been. I had a mind now to get some fuller intelligence of them. When I came to the place, my very blood ran chill in my veins at the horror of the spectacle. Indeed, it was a dreadful sight. At least it was to me. Friday made nothing of it. The place was covered with human bones, the ground dyed with their blood, and great pieces of flesh were left here and there, half-eaten, mangled, and scorched. I saw three skulls, five hands, and the bones of three or four legs and feet, and abundance of other parts of bodies. The trees and stones had been marked again as well. Friday, by his signs, made me understand they brought over four prisoners to feast upon. Three of them were eaten up, and he, pointing to himself, was the fourth. There had been a great battle between them and their next king, whose subject he had been one of, and they had taken a great number of prisoners in order to feast upon them. Whilst I took the hatchet again to the trees, I caused Friday to gather all the skulls, bones, flesh, and whatever remained, and lay them together in a heap, and make a great fire upon it, and burn them all to ashes. I found him unnerved by my destruction of the marks, and that he had still a hankering after some flesh and was still a cannibal in his nature. I discovered so much abhorrence at the very thoughts of it, I had, by some means, let him know I would kill him if he offered it. When he had done this, we came back to our castle, and there I fell to work for my man Friday. First of all, I gave him a pair of linen drawers, which I had out of the poor gunner's chest I found in the wreck. Then I made him a jerkin of goatskin, as well as my skill would allow, for I was now grown a tolerable good tailor. I gave him a cap, which I made of hare's skin. Thus he was clothed, for the present, tolerably well. It is true he went awkwardly in these clothes at first. Wearing the drawers was very awkward to him, and the sleeves of the waistcoat galled his shoulders and the inside of his arms, which had many thin folds of flesh, much like the fins of a fish. I bethought myself wearing clothes for him must be, as is for the beast, an unexpected and foreign experience, that is to say, one they had no call for. But after a little easing them, where he complained they hurt, and using himself to them, he took to them at length very well. The next day, after I came home to my hutch with him, I began to consider where I should lodge him. That I might do well for him, and yet be easy myself, I made a little tent for him in the vacant place between my two fortifications, in the inside of the last and in the outside of the first. As there was a door or entrance there into my cave, I made a formal framed door-case, and a door to it of boards, and set it up in the passage, a little within the entrance. I barred it up in the night, taking in my ladders, too. Friday could no way come at me in the inside of my innermost wall without making so much noise in getting over that it must needs waken me. But I needed none of all this precaution. Never man had a more faithful, loving, sincere servant than Friday was to me. His very affections were tied to me like those of a child to a father. I dare say he would have sacrificed his life for the saving of mine. The many testimonies he gave me of this put it out of doubt, and soon convinced me I needed to use no precautions as to my safety on his account. I was delighted with Friday, and made it my business to teach him everything that was proper to make him useful, handy, and helpful, but especially to make him speak and understand me when I spoke. He was the aptest scholar that ever was, and was so merry, so diligent, and so pleased when he could but understand me, or make me understand him, that it was very pleasant to me to talk to him. After I had been 2 or 3 days returned to my castle, I thought in order to bring Friday off from his horrid way of feeding, and from the relish of a cannibal's stomach, I ought to let him taste other flesh. I took him out with me one morning to the woods. I went, indeed, intending to kill a kid out of my own flock, and bring it home and dress it. But as I was going, I saw a she-goat lying down in the shade, and 2 young kids sitting by her. I catched hold of Friday. "Hold," I said, "stand still," and made signs to him not to stir. I presented my piece, shot, and killed one of the kids. The poor creature, who had indeed seen me kill the savage, his enemy, but did not know how it was done, was surprised, trembled, and looked so amazed I thought he would have sunk down. He did not see the kid I shot at, or perceive I had killed it, but ripped up his waistcoat to feel whether he was not wounded. He came and kneeled down to me, and, embracing my knees, said a great many things I did not understand. I could see the meaning was to pray me not to kill him. I laughed at him, and pointed to the kid which I had killed, beckoned him to run and fetch it, which he did. I brought home the kid, and the same evening I took the skin off, and cut it out as well as I could. Having a pot fit for that purpose, I boiled or stewed some of the flesh and made some very good broth. After I had begun to eat some, I gave some to my man, who seemed very glad of it, and liked it very well. The next day we roasted a piece of the kid. When Friday came to taste the flesh, he took so many ways to tell me how well he liked it that I could not but understand him. At last he told me, as well as he could, he would never eat man's flesh any more, which I was very glad to hear. The next day I set him to work to beating some corn out and sifting it in the manner I used to do, as I observed before. He soon understood how to do it as well as I, especially after he had seen what the meaning of it was. After that, I let him see me make my bread and bake it too. In a little time, Friday was able to do all the work for me, as well as I could do it myself. I began now to consider that, having two mouths to feed instead of one, I must provide more ground for my harvest, and plant a larger quantity of corn than I used to do. I marked out a larger piece of land, and began the fence in the same manner as before, on which Friday worked not only very willingly and very hard, but did it very cheerfully. I told him it was for corn to make more bread, because he was now with me. He appeared very sensible of that part, and let me know he thought I had much more labor upon me on his account than I had for myself. He would work the harder for me, if I would tell him what to do. Thus, 3 weeks passed, and I observed there was a point I had not considered, viz., in the many years upon this island, the nature of the beast had grown to be commonplace to me. It was as much a part of my routine as making my bread, or drying raisins, or milking my goats. Now it was the first night of the moon, and Friday, in his cheerful way, followed me everywhere I would go in my day, and would follow me out at night. Thus it was with great difficulty I explained he must stay within the castle this night, while I went down the hill and away. This upset him greatly, and he made it known to me that he must follow me and keep me safe. With much effort he then told me that his people were much afraid of this island at night, for their god had set a monster loose on it which killed all things. At this I laughed, for it was clear to me their monster was the beast, and it seemed I had been safer here than I had first thought. I told him his monster did not frighten me, and, in what was a small lie, that I kept the monster imprisoned and chained up for many days of the month, only setting it free to run for 3 nights, so it would stay in good spirits and behave. Although, upon reflection, this was not a lie at all, which pleased me. I told him again he could not follow, and I climbed up the ladder and over the wall. He did cry for me to return, and his laments recalled to my mind little Jury, the boy who had escaped with me from the moors of Sali. I did then observe that little Jury would be a man now, older than I was when I first awoke on this island. I walked a little ways from my castle, till I was well away and hidden from Friday's eyes. Then I removed my clothes and placed them upon a tree branch, as I had on the shores of Afric and my first nights there. I resolved, as the moon rose and bathed me in her light, that I should make a cabinet for my clothes outside the castle, perhaps 3 or 4, to place across my territory, so I could always find drawers each morning, at the least. Then the mantle of the beast did fall upon me, and it howled long and hard. It howled as it did to hunt and afore the kill, and ran across the hilltops barking, and I knew, even deep within its skin, that it wanted to put great fear into Friday. It smelled his relation to the savages, and to the dark church, and to the great totem, and it wanted Friday to know terror, and to know not to take any action against me. Had I not made my castle so well, I believe the beast would have killed Friday that first night. Because of this, when I awoke the next day, I did not return to the castle, but instead went to my bower, or summer house, as I called it, and spent much time in reflection. I bethought myself, and the beast, that Friday was a loyal servant, and yet cast off the rituals his people had raised him within. He would no longer eat the flesh of men, and would not raise his hand against me. I long observed these things, and made them clear to the beast as well. When the moon rose for the second night, the beast was tamer in its mood, yet still did howl and race across the hills, though I knew this was now in the manner of wolves, that it but established its place as above Friday in our small family, and second only to me. The next day I returned to the castle, where Friday was much relieved to see me, and bowed and made his many signs of thanks. He had scarce moved since I left, and had eaten nothing, lest he upset me somehow by doing so. I gave him some milk and bread, and we went to the shore and found a turtle, the flesh of which pleased him. I showed him how to cook the eggs in the shell, as it is called, and then told him I would need to spend one more night away, so they would be his supper, to cook when he became hungry, and eat with another cake of bread. I was surprised that this announcement met with no cries this time, and Friday gave a solemn nod and smiled at me. I asked him if he had been so worried afore about food. He shook his head and made it known that he had feared I was leaving him and would not return. When I asked why this did not worry him now, he smiled at me again with his thin white teeth and pointed up into the sky, where the last full moon had already risen in the afternoon sky. He tilted his head back and he did give a low howl. Then he gave me a most meaningful look with his large, dark eyes, spread his long fingers to show the tiny webs of flesh betwixt them, and set it against my chest. Before I could speak, he placed the hand against his own chest, then back to mine, and spoke a few words in the little English he had learnt so far. Although his words were few, his meaning was most clear to me. He had no fear, for he knew we were both monsters. Old Beliefs, The Moving Island, The Fallen. Friday began to talk pretty well, and understand the names of almost everything I had occasion to call for, and of every place I had to send him to. He talked a great deal to me. In short, I began now to have some use for my tongue again. Besides the pleasure of talking to him, I had a singular satisfaction in the fellow himself. His simple, unfeigned honesty appeared to me more and more every day, and I began to love the creature. On his side, I believe he loved me more than it was possible for him ever to love anything before. I had a mind once to try if he had a hankering inclination to his own country again. Having taught him English so well he could answer me almost any question, I asked whether the nation that he belonged to never conquered in battle. At which he smiled and said, "Yes, yes, we always fight the better." That is, he meant, always get the better in fight. So we began the following discourse. "You always fight the better," said I. "How came you to be taken prisoner then, Friday?" "My nation beat much for all that," he replied. "How beat? If your nation beat them, how came you to be taken?" He struggled for words. "Dey more many than my nation in de place where me was. They take 2, 3 and me. My nation overbeat them in the yonder place where me no was. There my nation take 1, 2 great 1,000.
"But why did not your side recover you from the hands of your enemies then?"
"They run 1, 2, 3 and me, and make go in the canoe. My nation have no canoe that time." It came to my thoughts what the results of this great fight had been. "Well, Friday," said I, "and what does your nation do with the men they take? Do they carry them away and eat them, as these did?" "Yes, my nation eat mans too," he nodded. "Eat all up."
"Where do they carry them?"
"Go to other place where they think."
"Do they come hither?"
"Yes, yes, they come hither. Come other else place."
Have you been here with them?
Yes, I have been here.
And with this he did point to the southwest of the island, which was their side. By this I understood my man Friday had been among the savages who used to come on shore on the farther part of the island, to the dark church and its totem, on the same man-eating occasions he was now brought for. I have told this passage because it introduces what follows. After I had this discourse with him, I asked him how far it was from our island to the shore, and whether the canoes were not often lost. He told me there was no danger, no canoes ever lost. After a little way out to sea, there was a current and wind, always one way in the morning, the other in the afternoon. This I understood to be no more than the sets of the tide, as going out or coming in. I afterwards understood it was occasioned by the great draught and reflux of the mighty river Orinoco, in the gulf of which river, as I found afterwards, our island lay. This land, which I perceived to be west and northwest, was the great island Trinidad, on the north point of the mouth of the river. I asked Friday 1,000 questions about the country, the inhabitants, the coast, and what nations were near. He told me all he knew, with the greatest openness imaginable. I asked him the names of the several nations of his sort of people, but could get no other name than Caribs, from whence I understood these were the Caribbees, which our maps place on the part of America which reaches from the mouth of the river Orinoco to Guiana. He told me up a great way beyond the moon, that was, beyond the setting of the moon, which must be west from their country, there dwelt white-bearded men like me, and pointed to my great whiskers, which I mentioned before. They had killed much mans. By all which I understood he meant the Spaniards, whose cruelties in America had been spread over the whole country, and were remembered by all the nations from father to son. I inquired if he could tell me how I might go from this island and get among those white men. "Yes, yes," he told me. "You may go in two canoe." I could not understand what he meant, or make him describe to me what he meant by two canoe, till, at last, with great difficulty, I found he meant it must be in a large boat, as big as two canoes. This part of Friday's discourse began to relish with me very well. From this time I entertained some hopes that, one time or other, I might find an opportunity to make my way away from this cursed place, and this poor savage might be a means to help me. During the long time Friday had now been with me, and he began to speak to me and understand me, I was wanting to lay a foundation of Christian knowledge in his mind. Particularly, I asked him one time, "Who made him?" The poor creature did not understand me at all, but thought I had asked him who was his father. Once he understood my question, he told me it was one great Cthulhu that lived beyond all. He could describe nothing of this great person but that he was very old, much older than the sea or the land, than the moon or the stars, and slept and dreamt for many years. At his mention of dreams, many of my old apprehensions did arise, and I did continue in a cautious manner. I asked him, then, if this old person had made all things, why did not all things worship him? He looked very grave, and said, "All things say O to him." I asked him if the people who die in his country went away anywhere. "Yes, they all went to Cthulhu." From these things I began to instruct him in the knowledge of the true God. I told him the great maker of all things lived up there, pointing up towards heaven. He was omnipotent, and could do everything for us, give everything to us, and take everything from us. Thus, by degrees, I opened his eyes. He listened with great attention, and received with pleasure the notion of Jesus Christ being sent to redeem us, and of the manner of making our prayers to God, and his being able to hear us, even in heaven. He told me one day, if our God could hear us up beyond the sun, he must needs be a greater God than their Cthulhu, who slept but a little way off on another island, and yet could not hear till they went up to the great mountains to speak to him. I asked him if ever he went thither to speak to him. He said no. They never went that were young men. None went thither but the old men, whom he called their Wallachay. That is, as I made him explain it to me, their religious, or clergy. They went to say, oh, so he called saying prayers, and then came back and told them what Cthulhu said. I asked him if any went to where their Cthulhu slept, to wake him, at which he seemed both terrified and amazed that I could ask such a thing. Great Cthulhu, he explained, could not awake or be awoken until the stars is right. He said also there were none who knew where this island was now, which I took to mean no one remembered. When I said this, he shook his head and said no, and did try to explain again. After many minutes, during which he moved shells and stones across the floor of my cave, I came to understand his words. The savages believed their Cthulhu's island had sunk beneath the waves in the distant past, as would a foundering ship, and now moved beneath the seas like some great whale or turtle, waiting to rise to the surface when the stars is right. It could be anywhere beneath the sea, observed Friday, very distant or very near. Thus, only their Wallachay could know where the island was at a certain time, and speak to their god. By this I observed there was priestcraft even among the most blinded, ignorant pagans in the world. The policy of making a secret of religion, in order to preserve the veneration of the people to the clergy, was not only to be found in the Roman, but perhaps among all religions in the world, even among the most brutish and barbarous savages. I endeavoured to clear up this fraud to my man Friday. I told him islands could not move beneath the sea. The pretense of their old men going up to the mountains to their god Cthulhu was a cheat, and their bringing word from thence, what he said, was much more so. If they met with any answer, or spake with any one there, it must be with an evil spirit. Then I entered into a long discourse with him about the devil, his rebellion against God, his enmity to man, the reason of it, his setting himself up in the dark parts of the world to be worshipped instead of God, and the many stratagems he made use of to delude mankind to their ruin. I found it was not so easy to imprint right notions in his mind about the devil as it was about the being of a god. The poor creature became insistent we again discussed his sleeping Cthulhu, and it was clear to me the two had become one in his mind, and it seemed easiest to continue his lessons with such a belief. He then so puzzled me by a question merely natural and innocent, I scarce knew what to say to him. I had been talking a great deal to him of the power of God, his omnipotence, his aversion to sin, his being a consuming fire to the workers of iniquity, and Friday listened with great seriousness to me all the while. After this, I had been telling him how Cthulhu was God's enemy in the hearts of men, and used all his malice and skill to defeat the good designs of Providence, and to ruin the kingdom of Christ in the world, and the like. "Well," said Friday, "but you say God is so strong, so great. Is he not much strong, much might as great Cthulhu?" "Yes, yes," said I. "Friday, God is stronger than Cthulhu. God is above Cthulhu, and therefore we pray to God to tread him down under our feet and enable us to resist his temptations." "But," he said again, "if God much stronger, much might as Cthulhu, why God no kill great Cthulhu in his sleep, so make him no more do wicked?" I was surprised at this question. After all, though I was now an old man, I was but a young doctor, and ill-qualified for a casuist or a solver of difficulties. At first I could not tell what to say, so I pretended not to hear him, and asked him what he said. But he was too earnest for an answer to forget his question, So he repeated it in the very same broken words as above. By this time I had recovered myself a little, and I said, "God will at last punish him severely. He is reserved for the judgment, and is to be cast into the bottomless pit to dwell with everlasting fire." This did not satisfy Friday, but he returns upon me, repeating my words. "Reserve at last? Me no understand. Why not kill great Cthulhu now? Why not kill great ago?"
"You may as well ask me," said I, "why God does not kill you and me when we do wicked things here that offend him. We are preserved to repent and be pardoned." He mused some time on this.
"Well, well," he said, "that well. So you, I, Cthulhu, all wicked, all preserve, repent, God pardon all."
Here I was run down again by him to the last degree. I therefore diverted the present discourse between me and my man, rising up as upon some sudden occasion of going out. Sending him for something a good way off, I prayed to God he would enable me to instruct this poor savage. When he came again to me, I entered into a long discourse with him upon the subject of the redemption of man by the Saviour of the world, and of the doctrine of the gospel preached from heaven. How the fallen angels had no share in the redemption, he came only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and the like. I had, God knows, more sincerity than knowledge in all the methods I took for this poor creature's instruction. In laying things open to him, I really informed and instructed myself in many things that either I did not know or had not considered before. I had more affection in my inquiry after things upon this occasion than ever I felt before. Whether this poor wild wretch was the better for me or no, I had great reason to be thankful that ever he came to me. In this thankful frame, I continued all the remainder of my time. The conversation which employed the hours between Friday and me was such as made the 3 years which we lived there together perfectly and completely happy. If any such thing as complete happiness can be formed in a sublunary state. This savage was now a good Christian, a much better than I.
Talk of boats, bearded men, my design. I acquainted Friday with my own history, or at least so much of it as related to my coming to this place. I let him into the mystery, for such it was to him, of gunpowder and bullet, and taught him how to shoot. I gave him a knife, which he was delighted with. I made him a belt with a frog hanging to it, such as in England we wear hangers in, and in the frog, instead of a hanger, I gave him a hatchet, which was not only as good a weapon in some cases, but much more useful upon other occasions. He also took to wearing the great wooden broadsword he had claimed from the other savage. It was carved of ironwood and very heavy, yet he did swing it with grace like the most skilled swordsman. I gave him an account of the wreck which I had been on board of, told him of the beast killing the mate, the panic in the water, and showed him, as near as I could, the place where the ship lay. However, she was all beaten in pieces before, and gone. I showed him the ruins of our longboat, which we lost when we escaped, and which I could not stir with my whole strength then, but was now fallen almost all to pieces. Upon seeing this boat, Friday stood amused a great while, and said nothing. I asked him what it was he studied upon. At last, said he, "Me see such boat like come to place at my nation." I did not understand him a good while, but at last, when I had examined farther into it, I understood by him a boat, such as that had been, came on shore upon the country where he lived. As he explained it, it was driven thither by stress of weather. I imagined some European ship must have been cast away upon their coast, and the boat might get loose and drive ashore. But I was so dull I never once thought of men making their escape from a wreck thither, much less whence they might come. So I only inquired after a description of the boat.
Friday described the boat to me well enough, but brought me better to understand him when he added with some warmth, "We saved the white mans from drown." Then I presently asked him if there were any white mans, as he called them, in the boat. "Yes," he said, "the boat full of white mans." I asked him how many. He told upon his fingers 17. And I asked him then what had became of them. He told me, "They live. They dwell at my nation." This put new thoughts into my head. I imagined these might be the men belonging to the Spanish ship that was cast away in the sight of my island, who, after the ship was struck on the black rocks, and they saw her lost, had saved themselves in their boat, and were landed upon that wild shore among the savages. Upon this, I inquired of him more critically what was become of them. He assured me they lived still there. The savages let them alone and gave them victuals to live on. I asked him how it came to pass they did not kill them and eat them. He said, "No, they make brother with them." Then he added, "They no eat mans, but when make the war, fight." It was after this some considerable time, being upon the top of the hill, at the east side of the island, Friday looked towards the mainland, and, in a kind of surprise, fell a-jumping and dancing, and called out to me, for I was at some distance from him. I asked him what was the matter. "Oh, joy," he said, "oh, glad, there see my country, there my nation." I observed an extraordinary sense of pleasure appeared in his face. His eyes sparkled, and his countenance discovered a strange eagerness, as if he had a mind to be in his own country again. This observation of mine put a great many thoughts into me, which made me at first not so easy about my new man Friday as I was before. I made no doubt but that if Friday could get back to his own nation again, he would not only forget all his religion, but all his obligation to me, and would be forward enough to give his countrymen an account of me, and come back perhaps with 100 or 2 of them, and make a feast upon me. But I wronged the poor honest creature very much, for which I was very sorry afterwards. One day, walking up the same hill, but the weather being hazy at sea, so we could not see the continent, I called to him and said, "Friday, do not you wish yourself in your own country, your own nation?" "Yes," he said, "I'd be much glad to be at my own nation." "What would you do there?" said I. "Would you turn wild again, eat men's flesh again, and be as savage as you were before?" He looked full of concern, and shaking his head said, "No, no. Friday tell them to live good. Tell them to pray God. Tell them to eat cornbread, cattle flesh, milk. No eat man again." "Why then," said I to him, "they will kill you." He looked grave at that, and then said, "No, no. They no kill me. They willing love learn." He meant by this, they would be willing to learn. He added, they learned much of the bearded mans that came in the boat. Then I asked him if he would go back to them. He smiled at that, and told me he could not swim so far. I told him I would make a canoe for him. He told me he would go if I would go with him. "I go," said I. "Why, they will eat me if I come there." "No, no," said he. "Me make they no eat you. Me make they much love you." Then he told me how kind they were to 17 white men, or bearded men as he called them, who came on shore there in distress. I confess, I still had a mind to escape away from the island, and see if I could join with those bearded men who, I made no doubt, were Spaniards and Portuguese. Upon the whole, I was by this time so fixed upon my design of going over with him to the continent and escaping the island, I told him we would go and make a boat, and he should go home in it. He answered not one word, but looked very grave and sad. I asked him what was the matter with him. He asked me, "Why you angry mad with Friday? What me done?" I asked him what he meant. I told him I was not angry with him at all. "No angry," said he. repeating the word several times.
"Why send Friday home away to my nation?"
"Why," said I, "Friday, did you not say you wished to be there?"
"Yes, yes," said he. "Wish be both there. No wish Friday there, no master there."
With a swift motion, he pulled out his great wooden sword and gave it to me.
"What must I do with this?" said I to him. "You take kill Friday," said he. "What must I kill you for?" said I again.
He returned very quick.
"What you send Friday away for?" "Take kill Friday. No send Friday away."
This he spoke so earnestly, I saw tears stand in his eyes. I told him then, and often after, that I would never send him away from me if he was willing to stay with me, for I knew now the depth of his loyalty to me and love for me. Therefore, without any more delay, I went to work with Friday to find out a great tree proper to fell and make a large canoe to undertake the voyage. The main thing I looked at was to get one so near the water we might launch it when it was made. At last, Friday pitched upon a tree. I found he knew much better than I what kind of wood was fittest for it. Friday was for burning the hollow of this tree out to make it for a boat, but I showed him how to cut it with tools. After I had showed him how to use these, he did very handily. In about a month's hard labor, we finished it, and made it very handsome when, with our axes, we cut and hewed the outside into the true shape of a boat. After this, however, it cost us near a fortnight's time to get her along, as it were, inch by inch, upon great rollers, into the water. But when she was in, she would have carried 20 men with great ease. When she was in the water, though she was so big, it amazed me to see with what dexterity and how swift my man Friday would manage her, turn her, and paddle her along. So I asked him if he would, and if he might venture over in her.
"Yes," he said, "we venture over in her very well, though great blow wind."
However, I had a farther design he knew nothing of, and that was to make a mast and a sail, and to fit her with an anchor and cable. As to a mast, that was easy enough to get. I pitched upon a straight young cedar tree, which I found near the place. I set Friday to work to cut it down, and gave him directions how to shape and order it, but as to the sail, that was my particular care. I knew I had old sails, or rather pieces of old sails enough, but as I had had them now 26 years by me, I did not doubt but they were all rotten, and, indeed, most of them were so. However, I found 2 pieces which appeared pretty good, and with these I went to work. With a great deal of pains and awkward stitching, I, at length, made a 3-cornered ugly thing, like what we call in England a shoulder of mutton sail, to go with a boom at bottom. I was near 2 months performing this task, viz. Rigging and fitting my mast and sails. I finished them very complete, making a small stay and a foresail to it, to assist, if we should turn to windward. More than all, I fixed a rudder to the stern of her, to steer with. I was but a bungling shipwright, yet, as I knew the usefulness and necessity of such a thing, I applied myself with so much pains to do it that, at last, I brought it to pass. Though, considering the many dull contrivances I had for it that failed, I think it cost me almost as much labor as making the boat. After all this was done, I had my man Friday to teach as to what belongs to the navigation of my boat. Though he knew very well how to paddle a canoe, he knew nothing what belonged to a sail and a rudder, and was most amazed when he saw me work the boat to and again in the sea by the rudder. I say, when he saw this, he stood like one astonished and amazed. However, with a little use, I made all these things familiar to him, and he became an expert sailor. The Dark Church Again. My Battle Orders. Friday's Reunion. I was now entered on the 26th year of my captivity in this place, Though the two last years I had this man with me ought rather to be left out of the account, my habitation being quite of another kind than in all the rest of the time. I kept the anniversary of my landing here with the same thankfulness to God for his mercies as at first. I had an invincible impression upon my thoughts that my deliverance was at hand, and I should not be another year in this place. I went on, however, with my digging, planting, and fencing as usual, and did every necessary thing as before. The rainy season was, in the meantime, upon me, when I kept more within doors than at other times. We had stowed our new vessel as secure as we could, bringing her up into the creek where, as I said in the beginning, I landed my rafts from the ship. Hauling her up to the shore at high water mark, I made my man Friday dig a little dock, just big enough to hold her, and just deep enough to give her water enough to float in. Then, when the tide was out, we made a strong dam across the end of it to keep the water out. She lay dry as to the tide from the sea. To keep the rain off, we laid a great many boughs of trees, so thick she was as well thatched as a house. Thus we waited for the months of November and December, in which I designed to make my escape. When the settled season began to come in, as the thought of my design returned with the fair weather, I was preparing daily for the voyage. The first thing I did was to lay by a certain quantity of provisions, being the stores for our voyage. I intended in a week or a fortnight's time to open the dock and launch out our boat. I was busy one afternoon upon something of this kind when I called to Friday and bid him go to the seashore to see if he could find a tortoise, a thing which we generally got once a week for the sake of the eggs as well as the flesh. Friday had not been long gone when he came running back and flew over my outer wall like one that felt not the ground or the steps he set his feet on. Before I had time to speak to him, he cries out to me, "O master! O master! O sorrow! O bad!" "What's the matter, Friday?" said I. "Oh, yonder, there," he said. "One, two, three, canoe. One, two, three." "Well, Friday," said I, "do not be frightened." However, I saw the poor fellow was most scared, for nothing ran in his head but that they were come to look for him, and would cut him to pieces and eat him. The poor fellow trembled so, I scarce knew what to do with him. I comforted him as well as I could, and told him I was in as much danger as he, and they would eat me as well as him. "But," said I, "Friday, we must resolve to fight them. Can you fight, Friday?"
"Me shoot," he said, "but dare come many great number."
"No matter," said I again, "our guns will fright them that we do not kill them." So I asked him whether he would stand by me and do just as I bid him. He said,
"Me die when you bid die, master."
I went and fetched a good dram of rum. When he drank it, I made him take the two fowling pieces, which we always carried. Then I took four muskets. By two pistols I loaded with a brace of bullets each. I hung my great sword naked by my side and gave Friday his hatchet and his wooden sword. When I had thus prepared myself, I took my perspective glass and went up to the side of the hill to see what I could discover. I found, by my glass, there were three canoes just reaching the southwest corner of the island, that place which I had named the Dark Church. There were no less than 24 savages on board, though it was possible some of the figures were prisoners. They passed from my sight as they reached the shore, yet I knew if they had made land at the Dark Church, there could be only two purposes to this visit, viz. An awful feast of flesh, else more of their accursed rituals, and very possibly both. This abhorrence of the inhuman errand these wretches came about filled me with such indignation, I came down again to Friday and told him I was resolved to go over to them and kill them all. I asked him again if he would stand by me. He told me, as before, he would die when I bid die. In this bit of fury, I took and divided the arms which I had charged between us. I gave Friday one pistol to stick in his girdle and three guns upon his shoulder. I took one pistol and the other three guns myself. I took a small bottle of rum in my pocket and gave Friday a large bag with more powder and bullets. I charged him to keep close behind me, and not to stir, or shoot, or do anything till I bid him. In the meantime, not to speak a word, and in this posture we set out at a run into the woods. My years on the island now served me well, for I knew each rock and tree and stump of the forest, and could run at full pace with little noise. In a word, the beast itself would be impressed if such a feeling were possible for it, though I did feel it within my skin, glorying in my own wild run the way it oft enjoyed its own. Friday, with his large feet and odd hunch, could not move with as little noise, but he did attempt it to his best and made a mighty effort to keep up. While we were making this march, my former thoughts were returning, and I began to abate my resolution. I do not mean I entertained any fear of their number. As they were naked, unarmed wretches, it is certain I was superior to them. But it occurred to my thoughts what occasion, much less what necessity, I was in to go and dip my hands in blood. It was true Friday might justify it, because he was a declared enemy, and in a state of war with those very particular people, and it was lawful for him to attack them. But I could not say the same with respect to myself. These things were so impressed upon my thoughts all the way as I went, I resolved I would only go and place myself near them that I might observe their barbarous feast, and I would act then as God should direct. It was at the moment of this resolution that Friday hissed and pointed up, and twixt the trees we saw a curl of black smoke rising up, for the savages had lit their fires by the great totem. We ran for yet another hour, till we came to the skirt of the wood on the side which was next to them, so only one corner of the wood lay between us and the area which I called the Dark Church. There were 21 grey-skinned savages, 3 prisoners, and 3 canoes. Their whole business seemed to be the triumphant banquet upon these 3 human bodies. A barbarous feast indeed, but nothing more than was usual with them. For now they twisted and bellowed around the fire and the totem, as was their way, and I could see that some among them were very monstrous and far more creatures than men, even for savages. Here I called softly to Friday, and showing him a great tree which was just at the corner of the wood, I bade him go to the tree and bring me word if he could see there what they were doing. He did so, and came back to me and told me they might be viewed there. They were all about their fire, eating the flesh of one of their prisoners, and another lay bound upon the sand by the great totem, which, he said, they would kill next. He told me it was not one of their nation, but one of the bearded men he had told me of. I was filled with horror, and, going to the tree, I saw by my perspective glass a white man who lay upon the sand beneath the carved figure of the totem, with his hands and feet tied with rushes. He was an European, and had clothes on. After this, whatever influence had clouded my mind with doubt was pushed away, and I resolved to kill them all. There was another tree, and a little thicket beyond it, about 50 yards nearer to them than the place where I was, which I saw I might come at undiscovered. But then I would be within half a shot of them. So I withheld my passion, though I was indeed enraged to the highest degree, and going back about 20 paces, I got behind some bushes, and then came to a little rising ground which gave me a full view of them at a distance of about 80 yards. I had now not a moment to lose, for 19 of the dreadful wretches now sat upon the ground all close huddled together, and had just sent the other 2 to butcher the poor Christian, and bring him, perhaps, limb by limb to their fire. They were stooping down to untie the bands at his feet, while the most of them pounded on the ground as a huge drum in a most off-putting way, while still braying their dark chants. I turned to Friday. "Now, Friday," said I, "do as I bid thee." He nodded. "Do exactly as you see me do. Fail in nothing." I set down one of the muskets and the fowling piece upon the ground, and Friday did the like by his. With the other musket, I took my aim at the savages, bidding him to do the like. I asked, "Are you ready?" "Yes." "Then fire at them," said I. And the same moment, I fired also. Friday took his aim so much better than I. He killed two of them and wounded three more. On my side, I killed one, though it was the most monstrous creature of them all, and wounded two. They were, you may be sure, in a dreadful consternation. All of them who were not hurt jumped upon their feet, but did not know which way to run or which way to look. Friday kept his eyes close upon me, that he might observe what I did. As soon as the first shot was made, I threw down the piece and took up the fowling piece, and Friday did the like. "Are you ready, Friday?"
"Yes. Let fly, then, in the name of God."
We fired again among the amazed wretches. As our pieces were now loaded with what I called swan shot, or small pistol bullets, we found only two drop, but so many were wounded they ran about roaring and screaming like mad creatures, all bloody, whereof three more fell after, though not quite dead.
"Now, Friday," said I, laying down the discharged pieces and taking up the musket which was yet loaded. "Follow me."
I rushed out of the wood and showed myself, and Friday close at my foot. As soon as I perceived he saw me, I shouted as loud as I could and bade Friday to do so too. Running as fast as I could, I made towards the poor victim. The two butchers had left him at the surprise of our first fire, fled in a terrible fright to the seaside, and had jumped into a canoe. Three more of the rest made the same way. I turned to Friday and bade him fire at them. He understood, and running about 40 yards to be nearer them, he shot at them. I thought he had killed them all, for I saw them all fall of a heap into the boat, though I saw two of them up again quickly. While my man Friday fired at them, I pulled out my knife and cut the rushes that bound the poor victim. Loosing his hands and feet, I lifted him up and asked him in the Portuguese tongue what he was. He answered in Latin, but was too weak and faint he could scarce stand or speak. I took my bottle out of my pocket and gave it him, making signs he should drink, which he did. I gave him a piece of bread, which he ate. Then I asked him what countryman he was, and he said, "Espagnole." Being a little recovered, he let me know, by all the signs he could make, how much he was in my debt for his deliverance. "Señor," said I, with as much Spanish as I could make up, "we will talk afterwards, but we must fight now. If you have any strength left, take this pistol and sword, and lay about you." He took them very thankfully. No sooner had he the arms in his hands, but, as if they had put new vigour into him, he flew upon his murderers like a fury, and had cut two of them in pieces in an instant. I kept my piece in my hand still, without firing, being willing to keep my charge ready, because I had given the Spaniard my pistol and sword. I called to Friday, and bade him run up to the tree from whence he first fired, and fetch the arms which lay there that had been discharged, which he did with great swiftness. Then, giving him my musket, I sat down myself to load all the rest again, and bade them come to me when they wanted. While I was loading these pieces, there happened a fierce engagement between the Spaniard and one of the grey-skinned savages, who made at him with one of their wooden swords, the same like weapon that was to have killed him before, if I had not prevented it. The Spaniard, who was as bold and brave as could be imagined, had fought this creature a good while, and had cut him two great wounds on his head. But the savage, being a stout, lusty fellow, had thrown him down, being faint, and was wringing my sword out of his hand. The Spaniard, wisely quitting the sword, drew the pistol from his girdle, shot the savage through the body, and killed him upon the spot. Friday, being now left to his liberty, pursued the flying wretches with his own great wooden sword in hand. With that he dispatched those three who were wounded at first and fallen, and all the rest he could come up with. The Spaniard pursued two of the savages and wounded them both, but as he was not able to run, they both got from him into the wood. Friday pursued them and killed one of them with a swift cut that took off his head, but the other savage was too nimble for him. Though he was wounded, yet had plunged himself into the sea and swam with all his might off to those two who were left in the canoe. I could not help but observe what powerful swimmers some of the savages were, as I had observed with my man Friday and his pursuers on the day of his escape from a like fate, as I have said before. Those that were in the canoe worked hard to get out of gunshot, and though Friday made two or three shots at them, I did not find that he hit any of them. Friday would fain have had me take one of their canoes and pursue them. Indeed, I was very anxious about their escape, lest carrying the news home to their people, they should come back perhaps with 200 or 300 of the canoes, and devour us by mere multitude. So I consented to pursue them by sea. Running to one of their canoes, I jumped in and bade Friday follow me. But when I was in the canoe, I was surprised to find another poor creature lie there, bound hand and foot for the slaughter, and almost dead with fear, not knowing what was the matter, for he had not been able to look up over the side of the boat. He was tied so hard, and had been tied so long, he had but little life in him. I cut the twisted rushes which they had bound him with, and would have helped him up. He could not stand or speak, but groaned most piteously, believing, it seems, he was only unbound in order to be killed. When Friday came to him, I bade him speak to him, and tell him of his deliverance. But when Friday came to hear him speak, and look in his face, it would have moved any one to tears to have seen how Friday kissed him, embraced him, hugged him, cried, laughed, hallooed. It was a good while before I could make him speak to me, or tell me what was the matter. When he came a little to himself, he told me it was his father, whom he called Wallachay. Friday was so busy about his father, I could not find in my heart to take him off for some time, but after I thought he could leave him a little, I called him to me, and he came jumping and laughing, and pleased to the highest extreme. I asked him if he had given his father any bread. He shook his head and said, "None. Ugly frog, eat all up self." I then gave him a cake of bread, out of a little pouch I carried on purpose. I also gave him a dram for himself, but he would not taste it, but carried it to his father. I had in my pocket 2 or 3 bunches of raisins, so I gave him a handful of them for his father. He had no sooner given his father these raisins, but I saw him come out of the boat and run away as if he had been bewitched. He ran at such a rate. He was the swiftest fellow on his feet I ever saw, even with his odd gait. He was out of sight in an instant, and though I called and hallooed out after him, away he went. This action put an end to our pursuit of the canoe with the other savages, who were now got almost out of sight. It was happy for us we did not, for it blew so hard within 2 hours after, and before they could be got a quarter of their way, and continued blowing so hard all night, I could not suppose their boat could live, or that they ever reached their own coast. Yet at the time I did not know this. As I bethought myself my concerns, Friday's father raised a weak hand and pointed at the great totem of the dark church, the cuttlefish figure of my dreams. He cried out many words, which had an awful memory to me, and I did recall across the years those words my parrot Paul had cried out before his death. Although now one of these words was not foreign to me, for I had discussed it with my man Friday many times, and that word was Cthulhu. This did cause me great discomfort, and the beast howled within my skin, and I was pleased when the old man let his hand drop and became silent again. In a quarter of an hour I saw Friday come back again, though not so fast as he went. As he came nearer, I found his pace slacker because he had something in his hand. When he came up to me, I found he had been to the summer house, which was nearer the dark church than my castle, for an earthen jug to bring his father some fresh water, and he had 2 more cakes or loaves of bread. The bread he gave me, but the water he carried to his father. The water revived his father more than all the rum or spirits I had given him, for he was just fainting with thirst. When his father had drank, I called to him to know if there was any water left. He said, "Yes," and I bade him give it to the poor Spaniard, who was in as much want of it as his father. I sent one of the cakes to the Spaniard, too, who was indeed very weak, and was reposing himself upon a not-as-red place under the shade of a tree, which had one of the old symbols carved in its bark. When I saw he sat up and drank, and took the bread and began to eat, I went to him, and gave him a handful of raisins. He looked up in my face with all the gratitude and thankfulness that could appear in any countenance, but was so weak Notwithstanding he had so exerted himself in the fight, he could not stand up upon his feet. By way of signs, he made it known to me that his name was Olegario, and I gave him my name as well, which brought a relieved smile to his face. Friday came back to me presently, and we two stepped away to the great totem. It was plain he did not like the thing, for he looked most reluctant to approach it. "Friday," said I, "do you know this man?" He shook his head, which I first took as a denial of knowledge, but then reflected that he objected to my calling the cuttlefish figure of the totem a man. "What is this?" I asked. Friday looked at me with his large, dark eyes and trembled.
"That great Cthulhu," he said, "who sleep and dream beneath the sea."
Though I suspected as much, this did make me tremble myself, and I repeated the question in the hope I had misunderstood my man, or he had misspoke to me. He said again the same, and seemed at sorts to be confronted by his former god. After some moments, his eyes met mine, and he said,
"All things say O to him."
I was aware of a noise, and saw that the father, Walla Kay, again had his hand pointed at the totem, and was repeating his words, although now as a penitent man says his prayers. I spoke to Olegario, the Spaniard, who let Friday help him up if he could. But Friday, a strong fellow, took the man quite up upon his back, and carried him away to the boat, and set him down upon the gunwale of the canoe, with his feet in the inside of it. Then lifting him quite in, Friday set Olegario close to Walla Kay, and launched the boat off, and paddled it along the shore faster than I could paddle my empty one. We brought them both safe into our creek an hour later. Friday then went to help our new guests out of the boat, but they were neither of them able to walk, so my poor man knew not what to do. To remedy this, I went to work in my thought. Calling to Friday to bid them sit down on the bank while he came to me, I soon made a kind of a hand-barrow to lay them on, and Friday and I carried them both up together upon it between us. But when we got them to the outside of our wall, we were at a worse loss than before, for it was impossible to get them over, and I was resolved not to break it down. So I set to work again. Friday and I, in about 2 hours' time, made a very handsome tent, covered with old sails, and above that with boughs of trees, being in the space without our outward fence, and between that and the grove of young wood which I had planted. Here we made them two beds of such things as I had. As soon as I had secured my two weak rescued prisoners and given them shelter, I began to think of making some provision for them. The first thing I did, I ordered Friday to take a yearling goat, betwixt a kid and a goat, out of my particular flock to be killed. Then I cut off the hinder quarter and, chopping it into small pieces, I set Friday to work to boiling and stewing, and made them a very good dish of flesh and broth, having put some barley and rice also into the broth. I carried it all into the new tent, and having set a table there for them, I sat down and ate my dinner also with them. Friday was my interpreter to his father, and to Olegario too, for he spoke the language of the savages pretty well. The Uninhabitable Island, The Harvest, Our Boat Sails Away. After we had supped, I ordered Friday to take one of the canoes and go and fetch our muskets and other firearms, which, for want of time, we had left upon the place of battle. The next day I ordered him to go and burn the dead bodies of the savages, which lay open to the sun and would presently be offensive. I also ordered him to burn the horrid remains of their barbarous feast, which I knew were pretty much, and which I could not think of doing myself. The thought of the dark church and its totem now gave me apprehensions, for I now suspected there may be more to Friday's god than a mere trick of savage priests. It was also made clear to me at this time that Walla Kay was both a name and a title, for I did notice this was the same word Friday had used for the old clergy of his people. As we would call a man captain or mate, so did the savages make this one and the same, and some would change names many times in their lives. Thus was Friday's father a priest of sorts, although I was not as quick to discredit their beliefs as I once had been, as I have said. I then began to enter into a little conversation with my two new subjects. First, I set Friday to inquire of his father what he thought of the escape of the savages in that canoe, and whether we might expect a return of them with a power too great for us to resist. Wallace's first opinion was the savages in the boat never could live out the storm which blew that night they went off, but must be drowned or driven south to those other shores where they were as sure to be devoured as they were to be drowned. As to what they would do if they came safe on shore, he said he knew not. But it was his opinion they were so frightened with the manner of their being attacked, the sudden noise, and the fire, that he believed they would tell the people they were all killed by thunder and lightning, and the two which appeared, viz. Friday and I, were two heavenly furies come down to destroy them, and not men. This he knew because he heard them all cry out the word Tyndlo, which is the word in their language for a spirit which appears and kills. In a little time, however, no more canoes appearing, the fear of their coming wore off. I began to take my former thoughts of an escape to the main into consideration, being likewise assured by Wallace I might depend upon good usage from their nation on his account, if I would go. He had questions for me as well, for he could not believe I had lived on this island for as many years as Friday and I told him.
"He say white mans cannot long live here," said Friday, interpreting his father's words. "This island strong for Cthulhu, weak for white mans. Only we people safe here."
At which his father slapped his own chest with his hand, which was much like the hand of his son, though, be it with longer nails, and, I observed, more flesh between the long fingers. Wallace had the same grey skin as my man Friday, his son, but also a wider mouth above his white beard and larger eyes. He looked to my eyes much like a grandfather frog, although I would never say as such to Friday. I assured him that my numbers were true, and offered to show him my calendar, or post, on which I still marked the day every morning. The old man shook his head and made it known again that I could not live here. Then he and Friday entered into a long debate, which I could not understand, that is to say, in their own language, and many times Friday did gesture at me and at the sky. Wallace's eyes opened wide, which was very wide indeed, and he reached out to brush my brow with a fingertip. He then sniffed his fingers, as a dog does take a scent, and I did see that he could smell the beast upon me. The old man found this acceptable, and did not doubt my word again. But my thoughts were a little suspended when I had a serious discourse with Oligario, and when I understood there were 16 more of his countrymen and Portuguese, who, having been cast away, lived there at peace with the savages, but were very sore put to it for necessaries, and indeed for life. I asked him all the particulars of their voyage, and found they were a Spanish ship, bound from Rio de la Plata to Havana, being directed to leave their loading there, and to bring back what European goods they could meet with there. They had 5 Portuguese seamen on board, whom they took out of another wreck. 5 of their own men were drowned when first the ship was lost, and these escaped through infinite dangers and hazards and arrived on the cannibal coast, where they expected to have been devoured every moment. He told me they had some arms with them, but they were useless, for they had neither powder nor ball. I asked him what he thought would become of them there, and if they had formed any design of making their escape. Oligario said they had many consultations about it, but having neither vessel, nor tools to build one, nor provisions of any kind, their councils always ended in tears and despair. I asked him how he thought they would receive a proposal from me which might tend towards an escape, and whether it might not be done. I feared mostly their treachery and ill usage of me if I put my life in their hands. Many is the sailor who would see a man of the beast, as myself, as less than a man, and worth no debt or promise, or that they could be even more than hostile to me. Gratitude was no inherent virtue, nor did men always square their dealings by the obligations they had received so much as they did by the advantages they expected. These were my thoughts, although I did not explain them all to Oligario at this time. I told him it would be very hard that I should be the instrument of their deliverance, and they should afterwards make me their prisoner in New Spain. I had rather be delivered up to the savages and be devoured alive than fall into the merciless claws of the priests and be carried into the Inquisition. I added that otherwise I was persuaded, if they were all here, we might, with so many hands, build a bark large enough to carry us all away, either to the Brazils, to the islands, or Spanish coast. But if they could carry me by force among their own people, I might be ill-used for my kindness to them, and make my case worse than it was before. He answered with a great deal of candor and ingenuousness. Their condition was so miserable, and they were so sensible of it, he believed they would abhor the thought of using any man unkindly that should contribute to their deliverance. If I pleased, he would go to them with the old man, for the other savages might be displeased if he returned alone, and discourse with them about it, and return again and bring me their answer. He would make conditions with them upon their solemn oath that they should be absolutely under my leading, as their commander and captain. They should swear upon the holy sacraments and gospel to be true to me, and to be directed wholly and absolutely by my orders till they were landed in such country as I intended. He would bring a contract from them for that purpose. Then he told me he would first swear to me himself that he would never stir from me as long as he lived till I gave him orders. He would take my side to the last drop of his blood if there should happen the least breach of faith among his countrymen. He told me they were all of them very civil, honest men, and they were under the greatest distress imaginable, having neither weapons or clothes, nor any food, but at the mercy and discretion of the savages. He was sure, if I would undertake their relief, they would live and die by me. Upon these assurances, I resolved to relieve them, if possible, and to send the old savage and Oligario over to them to treat. But when we had got all things in readiness to go, Oligario himself started an objection, which had so much prudence in it on one hand, and so much sincerity on the other hand, I could not but be very well satisfied in it. By his advice, put off the deliverance of his comrades for at least half a year. The case was thus. He had been with us now about a month, during which time I had let him see in what manner I had provided for my support. He saw what stock of corn and rice I had laid up, which, though it was more than sufficient for myself, it was not sufficient without good husbandry for my family, now it was increased to four. But much less would it be sufficient if his countrymen, who were, as he said, 16 still alive, should come over. Least of all would it be sufficient to victual our vessel, if we should build one, for a voyage to any of the Christian colonies of America. So he told me he thought it would be more advisable to let him and the other two dig and cultivate some more land, as much as I could spare seed to sow, and we should wait another harvest, that we might have a supply of corn for his countrymen when they should come. For want might be a temptation to them to disagree. "You know," said he, "the children of Israel, though they rejoiced at first for their being delivered out of Egypt, yet rebelled even against God himself when they came to want bread in the wilderness." His caution was so seasonable, and his advice so good, I could not but be very well pleased with his proposal, as well as I was satisfied with his fidelity. So we fell to digging, all four of us, as well as the wooden tools we were furnished with permitted. In about a month's time,
We had got as much land cured and trimmed up as we sowed 22 bushels of barley on, and 16 jars of rice. In short, all the seed we had to spare. Nor, indeed, did we leave ourselves barley sufficient for our own food for the 6 months we had to expect our crop. It is worth mentioning that for these months the moon still rose, and I still let the beast run free on those 3 nights it shone full in the sky. On the first night, which was a good week before Olegario had asked me to delay our voyage, the Spaniard was much concerned that I was to wander into the woods for the night. He, too, had heard the same stories of this island as Friday had once told me, and could not picture an older gentleman, as I now was, going unarmed into the woods where savage creatures hunted. Indeed, he asked such things several times as to how I had survived so long in such an awful place. It pleased me when Friday told him the same almost true story that I had once told to my man, that I was, in a word, the master of the beast, and went to set it free for a few nights necessary to keep it docile. Wallachay, when asked, confirmed this as well, and said in his sage way that he believed the beast would never harm me. Thus did we three keep my nature as a secret from Olegario, although I believe in the end he did suspect the truth. Having now number being sufficient to put us out of fear of the savages, we went all over the island whenever we found occasion, although none of us would go to the southwest corner, where the dark church still stood, except for Wallachay, who still kept his faith in his God, and would sometimes go there to pray, and would berate my man Friday, his son, for not joining him. This did cause a rift between them, though not, I believed, one of great consequence. I confess this faith did make me suspicious, and Wallachay never did earn my trust as well as had Friday. As we had our escape, or deliverance, upon our thoughts, it was impossible to have the means of it out of mine. For this purpose I marked out several trees which I thought fit for our work, and I set Friday and his father to cutting them down, though I may note I did not choose any tree which had been marked by the savages at one time, even if those marks had been removed. Then I caused the Spaniard, to whom I imparted my thoughts on that affair, to oversee and direct their work. I showed them with what pains I had hewed a large tree into single planks, and I caused them to do the like, till they had made about a dozen large planks of good oak, near 2 feet broad, 35 feet long, and from 2 to 4 inches thick. What prodigious labor it took up, anyone may imagine. At the same time, I contrived to increase my little flock of tame goats as much as I could. For this purpose, I made Friday and Olegario go out one day, and myself with Friday the next day, for we took our turns, and by this means we got about 20 young kids to breed up with the rest. Whenever we shot the dam, we saved the kids and added them to our flock. But, above all, the season for curing the grapes coming on, I caused such a prodigious quantity to be hung up in the sun, I believe we could have filled 60 or 80 barrels. These, with our bread, was a great part of our food, and was very good living, too, I assure you, for it is exceeding nourishing. It was now harvest, and our crop in good order. It was not the most plentiful increase I had seen in the island, but it was enough to answer our end. From 22 bushels of barley, we brought in and threshed out above 220 bushels, and the like in proportion of the rice. When we had thus housed and secured our magazine of corn, we fell to work to make more wicker ware in which we kept it. Olegario was very handy and dexterous at this part, and often blamed me that I did not make some things for defense of this kind of work. Indeed, in the final weeks of our harvest he had grown very sullen and angry, and did not sleep well. Wallachay advised me in private that in the same way the beast shared its nature with me, so did this island share its nature with those upon it, which is why he, at first, could not believe I had lived here my many years. He and his son Friday were protected as children of the sea, and I had the protection of the beast, but our Spanish friend had none to guard him from the island. Now having a full supply of food for all the guests I expected, I gave Olegario leave to go over to the main, to see what he could do with those he had left behind them there, and to free him from the nature of the island. I gave him a strict charge not to bring any man with him who would not first swear, in the presence of himself and the old savage, that he would no way injure, fight with, or attack the person he should find in the island, and this should be put in writing and signed with their hands. Under these instructions, Olegario and Wallace went away in the boat my man Friday and I had spent so many weeks making. I gave each of them a musket with a firelock on it, and about 8 charges of powder and ball, charging them to be very good husbands of both, and not to use either of them but upon urgent occasions. I gave them provision sufficient for themselves for many days, and sufficient for all the Spaniards for about 8 days' time. Wishing them a good voyage, I saw them go. They went away with a fair gale on the day the moon was at full, by my account in the month of October, but as for the exact reckoning of days, after I had once lost it, I could never recover it again. Another ship. Captives. My first victory. The day Olegario and Wallace left was the second full moon of October, a rare enough thing to be worth noting, and the beast did seem pleased to have the new arrivals gone, for it had ne'er warmed to Friday's father as it had to my man himself. On reflection, I took this to be because Wallace did not renounce his religion to the thing they called Cthulhu, and in this the beast and I were in agreement. It was no less than 8 days altogether I had waited for them, when again a strange and unforeseen accident intervened, of which the like has not perhaps been heard of in history. I was fast asleep in my hutch one morning, when my man Friday came running in to me and called aloud, "Master, master, they are come, they are come!" I jumped up and went out as soon as I could to get my clothes on. I was surprised when, turning my eyes to the sea, I saw a boat about a league and a half distance, standing in for the shore, with a shoulder of mutton sail and the wind blowing pretty fair to bring them in. I observed they did not come from that side which the shore lay on, but from the southernmost end of the island. I called Friday and bade him lie close, for these were not the people we looked for, and we might not know yet whether they were friends or enemies. I went in to fetch my perspective glass to see what I could make of them. I climbed up to the top of the hill to take my view the plainer without being discovered. I had scarce set my foot upon the hill when my eye plainly discovered a ship lying at anchor, about 2 leagues and a half distance from me, but not above a league and a half from the shore. By my observation, it appeared to be an English ship, and the boat appeared to be an English longboat. I cannot express the confusion I was in. The joy of seeing a ship, and one I had reason to believe was manned by my own countrymen, was such as I cannot describe. Yet I had some secret doubts hung about me. I cannot tell from whence they came, bidding me keep upon my guard. In the first place, it occurred to me to consider what business an English ship could have in that part of the world, since it was not the way to or from any part of the world where the English had any traffic. I knew there had been no storms to drive them in there. If they were English, it was most probable they were here upon no good design. I had better continue as I was than fall into the hands of pirates and murderers. I had not kept myself long in this posture, but I saw the boat draw near the shore, as if to look for a creek to thrust in at for the convenience of landing. However, as they did not come quite far enough, they did not see the little inlet where Friday and I docked our vessels, but run their boat on shore upon the beach, at about a mile from me, which was very happy for me. Otherwise they would have landed just at my door, and would soon have beaten me out of my castle and perhaps have plundered me of all I had. When they were on shore, I was satisfied they were Englishmen, at least most of them.
There were, in all, 11 men, whereof 3 of them I found were unarmed and bound. When the first 4 or 5 of them were jumped on shore, they took those 3 out of the boat as prisoners. One of the 3 I could perceive using the most passionate gestures of entreaty, affliction, and despair, even to a kind of extravagance. The other 2 I could perceive lifted up their hands sometimes and appeared concerned, indeed, but not to such a degree as the first. I was confounded at the sight, and knew not what the meaning of it should be. Friday called out to me, "Oh, master, you see Englishmans eat prisoner as well as savage mans." "Why, Friday," said I, "do you think they are going to eat them then?"
"Yes," said Friday,
"they will eat them."
"No, no," said I. "Friday, I am afraid they will murder them indeed, but you may be sure they will not eat them."